This is Michael Shannon, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Arizona History. Our first story is titled Arizona Place Names. It's not so much a story, but an article about how the character of Arizona is reflected in how places, areas, and groups of people acquired their names. Ever since man first set foot on this land called Arizona, he has felt compelled to name every river, waterhole, mountain pass, and trail. Inspiration was usually drawn from great natural spectacles and awesome beauty, but not always. Among Arizona's fabulous mineral-laden mountains lie the skeletal remains of storied ghost camps of yesteryear, born in boom and died in dust. The fragile wooden walls, concrete ruins, monuments to hopes and aspirations that didn't always pan out. These ghostly reminders of the past were generally populated by a variety of boisterous, rough, and tumble miners, generally characterized as unmarried, unchurched, and unwashed. They named their temporary abodes after former hometowns or countries, girlfriends, local geography, dappled with liberal touch of tongue-in-cheek humor. Others came to the land, promptly renamed or corrupted the original name to better suit their own linguistic abilities. Tucson gets its name from the dark base of nearby Sentinel Mountain. The Papago Indians usually named their communities for some conspicuous geographical feature and called their village at the foot of the mountain, Chukchun. The Spanish pronounced the name Tukishun, which eventually evolved into Tucson. When the early Spanish interlopers asked the river people living along the Gila what they called themselves, their response was Pim, meaning roughly, I don't understand. The Spanish interpreted Pim to be the name of the tribe, and the Akimil, Awatam, or river people, became the Pima. A similar incident occurred at the confluence of the Gila and Colorado rivers. When the Spanish asked to parley with the chief, a young man stepped forward, pounded on his chest, and replied Yuma, which meant son of chief. These people, who called themselves the Quechan, are still more familiarly known as the Yuma tribe, and have a city and county named in their honor. The Apache's name for themselves was Dene, meaning the people. Apache was a name coined by the Zuni people and popularized by the Europeans. The word means enemy. Navajo comes from similar origin. Closely related to the Apaches, they were dubbed Apaches de Navajo, or Apaches of the cultivated fields. The Spanish weren't the only ones guilty of misinterpretation. Sometimes lines of communications falter between peoples of the same language. During the 1880s, Henry Mortimer Cohn became postmaster of a small farming town in the Verde Valley. As was often the case in the birth of a community, the postmaster named the place after himself. In a letter to postal authorities, Mr. Cohn suggested the name Cohenville. Somebody in the nation's capital misread the name and officially dubbed the town Cohenville. Down near Organ Pipe National Monument is a junction in the highway. These junctions are usually referred to as Ys. In this case, one road led to Tucson, the other to Ajo, and a third to the Mexican border. When postal authorities asked the folks living at the junction what they wanted to call their community, their response was an emphatic Y. Something was lost in the translation, and with the wisdom known only to bureaucratic minds of officialdom, the name was approved in Washington, giving birth to the town of Huy, Arizona, to which some local wag no doubt responded, why not? Eloy is derived from a Syrian word Eloi, meaning my God. My God is one of those expressions that has many meanings depending on one's emotional response to a situation. If the Syrian who had decided to settle in the area had stepped down from the train in the middle of August, there is little room for doubt as to the intent of his descriptive response. There are names that might be categorized in the department of redundancy. The Spanish attached descriptive names to the landscape such as Mesa and Picacho. English-speaking people came along and thought the words to be pretty and interesting but not quite descriptive enough, so Mesa became Table Mesa and Picacho became Picacho Peak. Many of Arizona's communities have misleading names. Pine Top was not named for the famous Ponderosa that abounded in the area, but for a tall, bushy-headed bartender who operated the saloon there in the 1890s. Snowflake was named for the Mormon apostle Erastus Snow and early-day colonizer Jacob Flake. Total Wreck in Pima County became into being in the 1880s when a cowboy named John Dillon discovered a rich core body of silver. The hill above the ridge on which the mineral was discovered was considered by Dillon to be a total wreck. Today, Total Wreck is a ghost town, so there is some truth to the town name after all. Occasionally, early-day name-givers displayed a noticeable lack of imagination and creativity, such as naming a little green valley near Christopher Creek, Little Green Valley. The same might be said of such obvious place names such as Hilltop, Hillside, Ocotillo, Choya, Cactus, The Gap, Seven Springs, Fish Creek, and Big Bug. There are also some five or six Turkey Creeks scattered around the state and several rattlesnake basins, creeks, hills, and canyons. Arizona's best-known acronym is the range of mountains in Yuma County called the COFAs. COFA stands for King of Arizona, an early-day gold mining operation in the region. The state has been called a land of anomalies and tamales, referring to the many different people and diverse landscapes. There are many times when Arizona registers the nation's high and low temperatures on the same day. People have been known to snow ski and water ski on the same day. There are anomalies in place names, too. The town of Pima is not located in Pima County, but is in the Graham County. The town of Maricopa is found in Pinal County. To make matters even more confusing, the community of Navajo resides in Apache County, while Fort Apache is in Navajo County. Patriotism was the motivating factor in the naming of one of northern Arizona's most prominent cities. The party of immigrants bound for California camped at the foot of the San Francisco Mountains on July 4, 1876. To honor the nation's centennial, they raised the colors. To celebrate the occasion, they called the site Flagstaff. A group of miners in Santa Cruz County wanted to call their new town American Flag, but the idea was nixed in Washington, so the folks settled for Old Glory. In a surge of patriotic fever during World War I, residents of a minor community near Ajo wanted to call the town Woodrow to honor the president. Postal authorities refused to allow the town to be named after a living person, so the townspeople compromised and named the town Rowwood. The coming of the Atlantic and Pacific Santa Fe Railroad gave birth to several towns along the main line in northern Arizona. Sanders, Holbrook, Winslow, Seligman, and Kingman were all named for railroad officials or businessmen with a vested interest. The billion-dollar copper towns of Jerome and Bisbee were named for a couple of eastern investors, neither of whom ever took the time to visit their namesake. Women have played a prominent role in the naming of some Arizona towns and places. When polygamy was outlawed in Utah, those Mormons who wished to continue the practice built a community on the Arizona side of the border. They named their town Fredonia. The Free is self-explanatory, and Dona is Spanish for women, thus creating a free woman or Fredonia, Arizona. Sedona is named for Sedona M. Schnebly, a member of an early pioneer family in the area. Olive City was a small ferry boat crossing on the Colorado River, named to honor Olive Oatman, the young girl taken captive by hostile Indians in the 1850s. Miss Oatman survived her five-year ordeal in the Arizona desert and returned to the white society where she lived a long and productive life. Legend has it, the gold mining boom town of Oatman in Mojave County is also named for Olive. The town of Ruby was named for Little Ruby Andrews, who was one of the community's first few female residents. Black Jack Newman wanted to name the mining community that sprung up near Globe Mima, after his girlfriend Mima Toon. A group of miners who lived nearby hailed from Miami, Ohio. The names Mima and Miami blended together and eventually the latter won out. Mount Lemmon, one of the state's highest mountain ranges and America's southernmost skiing area, was named for Sarah Plummer Lemmon, who was the first white woman to climb to its summit. She made the trek on her honeymoon and made a return voyage when she was 70 years old. Arizona's capital city might have been called Salina, Stonewall, or even Pumpkinville, had it not been for the spurious English lord named Daryl Dupa. Dupa was a well-educated world traveler who, it was rumored, was given a substantial allowance by his wealthy English relatives to remain permanently at large. His raucous lifestyle, highlighted by epic bouts of dipsomania, was no doubt a source of embarrassment to his relatives and contributed to his banishments to Arizona. It was said Lord Dupa was fluent in seven languages. Unfortunately for his listeners, the erudite eccentric spoke all seven in the same paragraph. Dupa was a member of a committee chosen to select a name for the new settlement on the banks of the Salt River one sunny October day in 1870. An intrepid group of entrepreneurs led by Jack Swilling had cleaned out some prehistoric canals dug by the now vanished Hohokam people. An irrigation company had been organized and plans were made to develop farms. Soon, the arid valley would grow crops to supply the military post at Fort McDonald and the mining camps throughout the Bradshaw Mountains. Now they decided it was time to give the place a name. Swilling wanted to call the new settlement Stonewall after his hero, the late Stonewall Jackson. Another member chose Salina for the Salt River. Still another wanted Pumpkinville for the wild pumpkins growing in the area. When Dupa's turn came, he arose and waxed eloquently on the ancient civilization that had once flourished on the land where they stood. He predicted the rise of another great civilization on the same site. In his inimitable elocutionary style, Dupa compared the phenomenon to the mythical phoenix bird in Egypt that lived 500 years, then rose from its own funeral pyre to flourish again. Needless to say, Dupa's proposal carried the day. Soon after, Lord Dupa gazed wistfully across the Salt River to the mesquite and greasewood-covered desert behind the river, crossing at Hayden's Ferry, and declared the name reminded him of the beautiful verdant vale of Tempe in Greece. The local folks approved of the analogy, and the dusty Mexican village of San Pablo became Tempe. The name Arizona comes from the Papago Alishonac, meaning small spring. The name became popular following the discovery of rich lodes of silver, so pure you could cut it with a knife, some 25 miles southwest of present-day Nogales in 1736. The word was ultimately corrupted to Arizona. The silver didn't last long, but the world now knew of the fabulous planchas de plata, sheets of silver, and Arizona. Still, the area was known officially as New Mexico, or better yet, Terra Incognito, during the years of Spanish and later Mexican control. New Mexico became a part of the United States following the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, and Arizona remained a part of New Mexico. The Compromise of 1850 brought New Mexico into a union as a territory. Shortly after, the citizens in the western part of New Mexico began clamoring for separate status. Several names were suggested, including Arizona and Gadsonia, the latter to honor James Gadsden, the man who had negotiated the purchase of land south of the Gila River in 1853. The name Arizona won out, and in 1863 there was at last a real Arizona. We Arizonans have inherited a litany of picturesquely whimsical place names bestowed by cowboys, miners, prospectors, and others who arrived in the 19th century, and at least one town can lay claim to its existence from the result of a massive hangover. In the spring of 1876, Charlie McMillan and Theodore Harris had been on a glorious binge in Globe, where the local liquor contained 1,000 songs and 100 fights to the barrel. It was said Charlie was so drunk he couldn't hit the ground with his hat in 3 tries. The next day, he and Dorr were prospecting out north of Globe. Suddenly, Charlie declared he was too ill to proceed and collapsed in deep slumber on the ground. Dorr was a prospector true to the code, which was, roughly stated, "Whenever and wherever the opportunity arises, take thy pick and hammer and crush rocks." This he did, and somewhere near the body of his sleeping companion, he uncovered a rich load of silver. The fabulous Stonewall Jackson mine was born on the spot. Before the boom ended, some $2 million in silver had been removed. A town sprang up and was called McMillanville in honor of Charlie's $2 million hangover. That brings us to the end of Arizona place names. Our next story is titled The Saga of an Abandoned Baby. Stories of whiskeys and saloons are a staple of Arizona lore, but none is better than the tale that unfolded on a snowy night in Prescott in January 1898 when a mysterious woman dropped a baby girl onto the bar of a Whiskey Row saloon and disappeared out the batwing doors. The stir this callous act caused was great as hardened men clamored to claim the waif as their own. The story has been repeated a number of times in various books and journals, but never quite accurately. Its originator was an aging pioneer who sat down late in life to pen his recollections, and memory failed him. Edmund Wells's book, Argonaut Tales, was published in 1927 when the author was 81. He came to Prescott by wagon in 1864, just after the town's founding, and had every reason to believe that what he had seen and lived over the next five decades belonged in print. His book recounted some fine stories, including his version of what happened that night when the baby was abandoned in the saloon. Wells wrote that the bar in which the baby was left was called Cobweb Hall, the name of an actual Whiskey Row saloon at the time, and the man who ultimately won the little girl with a lucky roll of the dice was Charles Hill, a Prescott probate judge. As Wells tells it, Hall named his adopted daughter Chance, and she went through life as Chance Cobweb Hall. But Wells, a respected man, Republican candidate for governor in 1912, and former president of the Bank of Arizona, was incorrect in some key facts. The bar in question was not Cobweb Hall. It was the Cabinet Saloon, also located on Whiskey Row, and the name of the probate judge was Charles Hicks, not Charles Hall. These errors sent later writers down blind alleys in digging for more facts, but as so often happens, the truth was just as good. The cabinet was crowded with revelers that Monday night in 1898. The noise and chaos were perfect cover for the woman carrying what looked like a bundle of blankets. She wore a heavy veil to mask her face and worked quickly. Bartender Frank Williams studied her and saw that the blankets held a baby, but he was so astonished that the woman departed before he could speak. Prescott's newspapers jumped on the story. The Evening Courier called it the sensation of the season, and the Journal Miner said it caused an uproar almost equal to that generated by a recent robbery at the Palace Saloon. The Miner said the baby arrived in the midst of a high-stakes faro game, and while the sweet singer that holds sway on the stage at the rear of the saloon was belting out a song. All other business was brought to a standstill while the crowd gathered around the bar where the little one had been deposited. The paper reported on January 26, 1898, as it was impossible for all to get near, one of the employees got up and explained the situation and read the note left with the baby. It was unsigned, badly written, and reproduced as it is in the Prescott newspapers. Mr. Saloon Keeper, dear sir, here is a babe that belongs to William Bell, and he has left it on an invalid woman who has no one to do anything for her and is at this time sick in bed, and his child is suffering for care, and she had sent it down here to its father, hearing that he was there at your saloon of nights, and will you be so kind as to give the child in his hands or give it to the sheriff? For the woman is not able to keep the child, nor cannot do it if he was paying her, for he has nothing for it. Bell had been a regular at the cabinet in the weeks prior to the baby's appearance, but he was not present that night. The mother, Mary Bell, had two other children older than 8 months old baby Bell, as she was came to be called, but Mary wasn't at the cabinet that night either. She had been ill in the county hospital and had recovered sufficiently to be discharged. She found work in Jerome and left the child in Prescott with her mother, the baby's grandmother. If Mary Bell wasn't the veiled woman who entered the cabinet that night, who was? It's highly unlikely that any grandmother would abandon her own grandchild in such a way. And Barkeep Williams said he had never seen the woman before. To this day, her identity is unknown. But that didn't matter to the men at the cabinet. These brawny miners, ranchers, and railroad hands, their passions boosted by whiskey, were so taken with their chubby little cooing guest, that they cooed like fools right back at her. They made various suggestions for the girl's proper upbringing and welfare. Each put in his own passionate claim for her adoption, even though their combined knowledge of infants wouldn't fit into a brandy snifter. Not less than 40 men said they wanted to take the little one home, said the courier. Several babeless married men almost came to blows over the possession of the little one, while Frank Williams, the genial mixologist, rushed out to get two baby bottles and filled them both with milk. The black-eyed beauty seemed to have a particular attachment to Williams. The miner reported that when the baby heard his voice, it turned its eyes toward him and, smiling innocently, extended one of its plump little hands towards him as much as to say, "Be my friend," and shake. Precisely how Hicks wound up with the baby is uncertain. The miner reported that Judge Hicks, who had been sent for, decided the custody in question by summarily announcing that he would take the baby himself. But it's unlikely, given the excitement over her, that Hicks could prevail simply by declaration. The courier's explanation, equally brief, Hicks finally captured the cherub and sent it home. Didn't mention gambling specifically, but implies that she was won in some fashion, and a hot faro game indeed had been going on at the time the baby was left. Wells wrote extensively of the dice-throwing contest that decided the winner, and in this regard, his version is more believable. It was, after all, an eyewitness, and broad events are easier to remember 30 years after the fact than specific names of people and businesses. And most significantly, the gambling claim is corroborated by the obscure agricultural journal called The Irrigation Age, which published a blurb on the episode in its February 1898 issue. It said, "The judge assured the unsuccessful men that he would invest the $300 that he won in the game that evening for the child's benefit." In Argonaut Tales, Wells wrote that the arguing men agreed to settle the dispute with throws of the dice at $10 apiece. As the game progressed, cheers went up when high numbers were made by various throws. Bachelor Robert Groom, a civil engineer by profession but a prospector and miner by occupation, threw four fives and was by acclamation declared the winner. Amid the cheers, he tilted his broad-brimmed hat back onto the crown of his head, stroked his long beard, and smiled proudly. But he hadn't won yet. Judge Hicks stepped forward and said in a loud voice, "I have the last throw." He squared himself in front of the bar as the crowd edged back to give him plenty of room. He shook the box vigorously and twirled the dice upon the bar, rolling four sixes. Shouts of joy went up from everyone but Groom. The judge was showered with congratulations, although he wasn't above suspicious for having thrown loaded dice. But the men of the cabinet could hardly say goodbye to this knight or any other so easily. "Hold on," Judge Hicks called. "Boys, before closing, let's take one out on me. Fill her up to the top." After a final reverent swallow, the men filed out into the cold night. Although he could hardly have been an eyewitness to the judge's domestic scene, Wells continued with his account in great sentimental detail, writing that dawn was breaking when Hicks carried his new baby home. As he entered his front door, the judge handed the bundle to his wife. She received it as if it were an anniversary present. Then she moved aside the blankets and saw the baby. After a pause, she laid it aside as a shadow crossed her face. She looked at her husband, then the baby, then back at him. Truth be known, she was having much the same reaction as the men who figured Hall had used loaded dice. "Charles, I never thought this of you," she said, her cheeks flushing and her lips quivering. "Be patient, dear, till I tell you the story of this baby," pleaded the judge, at the same time stirring the fire in the stove. They drew chairs near the blaze, and he told the story. She kept her eyes on his face, searching. Conscious that she was weighing his veracity, he was careful not to wobble in his narration. When he had finished, she had tears in her eyes. She took the baby into her lap and looked into its large eyes. They were black, while her husband's were light blue-gray. "Charles, I believe every word you say," she said with feeling. "It's fortunate the little motherless thing found its way to our door. Let's give it the best care and protection our meager fortune will provide." At last, that was how Wells described the scene in his book, even if he did get the judge's name wrong. The sheriff found William Bell in Crown King in the Bradshaw Mountains and brought him to jail in Prescott. His abandonment trial in late January, he was defiant in tone and manner, indicating in the words of the reporter present that he felt like breaking out and had a struggle to control himself. The trial judge didn't buy Bell's argument that he couldn't support his daughter, fined him $25, and sentenced him to 25 days in jail. As for baby Bell, now named Violent, and the legal daughter of Charles and Laura Hicks, she moved into a home with two servants and with Wells' book Into Arizona Legend. The story of Violet's abandonment and adoption is still a favorite of Prescott's downtown tour guides, and in 1972, the pulp Western magazine Frontier Times, using the name C.C. Hall, told of an unsubstantiated reports that she was still living in Prescott under an assumed identity and in the shadow of Old Whiskey Row. But that was false. So was Wells' claim based on a surprise meeting with Violet 2 decades later in the lobby of San Francisco's Palace Hotel, that she was prosperous and happily married a former student at Oakland's Mills College. The truth couldn't have been more different or more tragic. After a good and prosperous childhood in Prescott, during which she rode horses before she could walk, Violet moved to California and married Arthur Binner, an architectural sculptor. The couple settled in Oakland into a marriage that was initially happy, according to Violet's son, Charles Binner, but Arthur, an abusive alcoholic, abandoned the family about 1930, leaving Violet alone with 4 children. One of them, a son, was killed in a freak accident while playing in the surf on a San Francisco beach. "My mom had a really tough life after Dad left," says Chester, born in 1925, a retired metal worker in Grass Valley, California. "She was a good mother before that, but afterwards she changed. She was unhappy and bitter. She liked to play the horses, and when she won, she took us to the circus, and when she lost, the landlord was pounding on the door. I remember coming home and eating an onion for dinner because there was no food in the house." Violet always had a strong interest in establishing a relationship with her birth parents. Chester said she tracked down Mary Bell and visited her periodically in Santa Monica, eventually establishing a good relationship. Remarkably, she had also found William Bell in Alaska. But in a poignant postscript to Arizona's most famous saloon story, Violet was rejected by her dad. When she traveled to Alaska to meet him, he turned her away, saying he wanted nothing to do with her, the very same reaction he had at her birth. Violet Binner, Prescott's legendary baby on the bar, died of a heart attack October 12, 1970, in Redwood City, California. She was 72 years of age. That brings us to the end of the saga of an abandoned baby. This is Michael Shannon, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Arizona History.